and Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and thanks for taking time to be with us tonight. Tonight I have with us a person that I'm very excited to interview, actually. It's new information, something that we've not talked about before, and something that's very important. In fact, the most important thing probably right now in the detection and prevention of disease early. We have Dr. Kilmer McCulley tonight, and he is one of, if not the foremost expert on homocysteine. How are you, Dr. McCulley?
I'm fine. It's a pleasure to be with you and your radio audience tonight.
Thank you so much. I've been excited to have you for quite some time now. So before we get started, I'd like to, for you to take just a couple minutes and tell people who you are and where you are. And I know you've written 4 different books, and I know several articles, and just tell people where they can find those things.
Right. My name is Kilmer McCulley. I'm a doctor, and I work for the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. I'm the director of the Pathology and Laboratory Medicine Service. I'm also the medical director of all of the laboratories in the New England region in the VA system. I got interested in this homocysteine question some years ago, and I've been working on it, and it has occupied most of my career. I also have an appointment at Harvard Medical School. I am a graduate of Harvard College and Harvard Medical School. I trained at the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, and I had training at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, and also a very interesting year in genetics at the University of Glasgow in Glasgow, Scotland. And in my background, I've been very interested in the biochemistry and molecular biology of diseases. And years ago, I was privileged to work with Jim Watson for a while at Harvard before I went into pathology. And so that's a little bit about my background.
And what are your books, and where can we find them?
Well, I've published actually 4 books. The first book is called The Homocysteine Revolution, Medicine for the New Millennium. That was originally published by Keats and in 1997, and it's been republished in 1999 and is still available. It's actually now managed by the Macmillan Group. The second book I published is called The Heart Revolution. This was published in 2000, the extraordinary discovery that finally laid the cholesterol myth to rest. My daughter Martha and I put this book together. These books are intended to explain what the homocysteine theory of disease is and make it accessible to the general reader, also with some suggestions on how to use the theory to prevent disease in their own lifetime. The third book I recently published in 2013, called The Pioneer of the Homocysteine Theory. It's published by Nova Science, and it really is my scientific memoir. It tells how I discovered this theory in 1968 and what happened to me as a result of this theory. It's a long, involved process, but it involves a description of my grandparents and their origin and my experiences at Harvard Medical School and all my various adventures in science and how I came up with this theory, and explain some details about the theory. And the final book is called Homocysteine Biosynthesis and Health Implications. I'm the editor of this book. This was published last year. It's a multi-authored book. These are scientists from around the world who have contributed chapters to this book and explaining the importance of homocysteine in aging, diseases of aging, and other important diseases and medical conditions.
Thank you. I'm very honored to have you, Dr. McCulley, so I just want you to know that.
Thank you.
Started here. Now, this is a little bit off topic, but I kind of want to start it this way because My show is also not only about scientifically bridging the gap in science and medicine, but also helping the people deal with the human spirit part of life. And I know from my other friends that are pioneers that sometimes being a pioneer is a tough road. So I can imagine that you probably had some tough roads because you're a pioneer and had new things. Is that true? Yes,
oh, yes. I had my difficulties. As I mentioned, my pedigree is a Harvard's, regular Harvard training and education and training. And I actually worked on the staff at the Massachusetts General Hospital for 11 years following my residency when I had the opportunity to develop this theory. I had grants from the National Institutes of Health, the American Heart Association, Massachusetts Heart Association, the American Cancer Society, that supported me for 11 years. And I was really taken by surprise at the end of that period when my chief had retired and the new chief gave me an ultimatum that basically I had to leave. And I thought that my findings and my publications spoke for themselves and that I had made some interesting observations and advances in science. And I was taken by surprise by this. But then, more than that, for the next 2 years, I had difficulty finding a position anywhere. So the word was out that the elders at Harvard had decided that my theories were and discoveries were not worthy of their interest, and they made sure that I couldn't get a position anywhere else in the country for 2 years. So finally, at the end of this period, I actually consulted with a very prominent attorney in Boston about the situation, and he helped me get out of my predicament, and I ended up as a staff pathologist at the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Providence, Rhode Island. And I was there for 20 years, and I was able to continue my research in homocysteine using funds from my collaborators. Of course, having left Harvard under a cloud of question and suspicion and negative emanations, I was never able to obtain grant money after that. But I was able then to continue my research at the Providence VA Medical Center, where I continue the work, and now today I have recovered from that episode, and there's more general acceptance of this approach than there was, say, 30 years ago.
Well, I certainly don't want to focus on the negative. I just wanted people to know, because when you start researching somebody, the Internet, of course, always bolds, highlights or bolds that one little negative thing, and I wanted people to know what you're doing is amazing, and it's important. And now doctors are finally saying, Jeffrey Bland just wrote a new book the other day that he published, The Disease Delusion. And he said in his book, homocysteine is probably the single most important lab result that you can test to early detect and prevent disease today. But most people don't know that, so I thank you for taking the time to come on, and I just wanted people to know that trailblazers sometimes suffer, but you persevere and get through, which you did. So now I want you to tell us quickly what homocysteine is and why it's important. But since you have a lot of information, I want to spend most of the time on telling us how do we know that something's wrong, how do we fix it, how can we tell when it slides, and what symptoms do we might have, and what kind of problems does it cause? So I'll just let you go and start with that one question.
Sure.
Me some questions, and all those questions work for me.
All right.
I like that.
Homocysteine is an amino acid. It contains sulfur. It's normally present in the human body, and actually in widespread in all living cells. It's an important intermediate in metabolism of amino acids. It contains a sulfur atom and is closely related to the amino acid methionine. Methionine is one of the essential amino acids that you have to get from your food. Your body does not synthesize it. But this amino acid was discovered in 1932 by a famous American biochemist, Vincent Duvigneau. And in the 30s and 40s and 50s, a great deal was found out about the importance of this amino acid in metabolism. But very little was known about the effects or possible effects on human disease until 1962, when a new disease was discovered, actually simultaneously in several laboratories in different parts of the world. But the most important report was from Northern Ireland. In 1962, there was a study of a series of children with mental retardation from a home in Belfast, Northern Ireland. These children had accelerated growth. They were taller than their brothers and sisters. They had dislocated optic lenses, which is an unusual condition. And they found that they were susceptible to thrombosis, either venous thrombosis or arterial thrombosis, that is blockage of veins or arteries that caused various vascular diseases. And this condition was traced to an abnormal enzyme by actually a former colleague of mine, Harvey Bunt, at the National Institutes of Health, and his team showed that this enzyme cystathionine synthase was deficient in these children. And as a result, this amino acid homocysteine built up in the blood and seemed to cause all of these abnormalities. So this is really was the first indication of the importance of this amino acid in human disease. I got interested in this about 6 years later, 1968, when I ran across a case of homocystinuria that actually had been published in 1933. It was an archival case of an 8-year-old boy who came in with symptoms of a stroke, and he had mental retardation. He also had dislocated lenses, and he developed a thrombosis of the carotid artery and a massive stroke of the brain, and he died. And in the autopsy and the report that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, Dr. Tracy Mallory, the pathologist, commented that the arteries to the brain showed arterial changes of arteriosclerosis and led to this thrombosis and death from this complication. I immediately became fascinated by this, and working with the pediatricians at Mass General Hospital, I traced down this old case and restudied the case. And the reason that this was discovered was that the pediatricians at Mass General had a young girl, I think she was about 9 years old, with similar symptoms. She had mental retardation and dislocated lenses, and they discovered homocysteine in her urine. And then the mother of this child told the pediatricians that, that an uncle had died of a similar disease, and it was published in the New England Journal. So it's a very interesting story about this discovery.
Can I ask you a question here?
Sure.
Because it's fascinating. And how high were the levels in these children?
Well, of course, in the old days, there was no way of measuring, and they didn't even know that this child had homocystinuria. It was only in 1970 when this case, or 1968 actually, when this case was discovered at Mass General of the niece of this child that they discovered. And the levels, to answer your question, the levels can be extremely elevated. The normal level of homocysteine is about 4 to 8 in a younger person. In an adult, it's about 8 to 12 or 8 to 11. But these children may have levels of 100 to 200
oh, wow.
Micromoles per liter, so extremely elevated levels.
Okay, sorry. I just wanted something to compare with so we could understand. Sorry.
Right.
Go ahead.
And then,
sorry.
The next thing that happened, because I had this experience at the National Institutes of Health with Harvey Mudd and Dr. Cantoni in that 2-year stint that I had there, I knew about the biochemistry of this amino acid, and I became intensely interested in this. And then, fortunately, about several months later, about 4 or 5 months later, a second case of homocystinuria was discussed at the Human Genetics Conference at Massachusetts General Hospital. This was a 2-month-old baby boy who was referred into the hospital because of pneumonia and failure to grow, and they discovered homocysteine in the urine of this baby. And they also discovered another amino acid, cystathionine, which was the next step in the pathway, in the metabolic pathway. So it meant that this child had a different enzyme defect. And it was eventually shown that this child had a vitamin B12 problem. And because of this problem, that both the homocysteine and cystathionine became elevated in the blood and the urine. And this baby boy died despite all of the vitamins, the different therapies that were tried. And the case was sort of forgotten, and I went back to the files, and I found this case, and I restudied this case, and I discovered that this baby boy had a very rapidly advancing arteriosclerotic lesions, or arterial plaques in his body. And it confirmed my hypothesis that the homocysteine was causing the arterial plaques in the body of this baby. So I published my first article in 1969 in which I described these two cases, and then I called attention to the possibility that elevation of blood homocysteine was likely to be of importance in diseases in the general population and people who didn't have these rare enzyme abnormalities. So that's basically how it was discovered.
Where do these enzyme abnormalities come from? What makes them start happening? What makes them start expressing?
They're inherited. These are genetically determined. The parents most likely had a heterozygous condition, that is, one gene was abnormal, the other was normal. But in this child, both genes were abnormal, so the enzyme didn't function normally. It had an abnormal structure. And this has been very well worked out over the succeeding years. The other interesting thing is, after I published my original paper in 1969, a study was published from Chicago showing that a third major enzyme defect causing elevation of homocysteine, methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase. I know that's a mouthful, but it's a related enzyme in this pathway causing elevation of blood homocysteine. And they had, I think, a 9-year-old girl with this problem, and when she died also, and they discovered arterial plaques that were virtually identical to what I had described and others had described in homocystinuria. So it was independent confirmation that indeed the elevation of blood homocysteine is extremely important in causing plaques, at least in these children with these inherited enzyme defects.
So when you say plaques, you don't mean the plaques that were people used to think was cholesterol or calcium, right? Is it more inflammatory things? What is it exactly?
Well, you see, I'm a pathologist, so this is what I study. And I was, of course, aware of the various theories about cholesterol and its importance in human arteriosclerosis. But in these children, the plaques contain, as you mentioned, calcium. They contain degenerating cells and some thrombosis or some microthrombosis. And but they don't contain much fat or lipid or cholesterol. So they were really a different type of arteriosclerosis than the usual. Now, in subsequent years, it's been found that in people in the general population who have vascular disease and arteriosclerosis, for example, abdominal aortic aneurysm, which is a common problem, a complication of arteriosclerosis, or sometimes called atherosclerosis, virtually identical. These individuals have an elevated homocysteine level and have an increased risk of complications of this vascular condition. And you mentioned inflammation. It's very interesting that in these arteries in the aortic aneurysm, if you look in the layers of tissue around the aorta, there's inflammatory changes, there's inflammation. This is actually what was known in the 19th century by pathologists in the 19th century, that the inflammation somehow starts in the outer layer, so-called adventitial layer, surrounding the artery. So this is a clue that actually we've been very interested in more recently.
So what do you do to fix that homocysteine short of some kind of pharmaceutical miracle, as they say? Is there something that you can do with your diet that really will intervene?
Absolutely, yes. The level of homocysteine in the blood is very critically dependent on three B vitamins. Vitamin B12, which is called cobalamin, vitamin B6, which is called pyridoxal, and vitamin B9, which is called folate. These three B vitamins are very critical in this pathway of metabolism involving homocysteine. And if there is a deficiency in any of these vitamins, the homocysteine level tends to go up. So this is one thing that the person can do to prevent this elevation of homocysteine is to eat a nutritious diet that has plenty of these vitamins in them. And unfortunately, over the earlier part of the 20th century, processed foods were introduced that were actually deficient in these vitamins. And there was the process of the heating and the chemical additives, the milling of grains, a lot of these different traditional methods of food processing, canning, for example, tend to destroy these two vitamins, folate and B6, because they are heat sensitive and sensitive to chemical degradation. So the introduction of a lot of processed foods, including sugar, white flour, canned goods, other highly processed foods, and also oils that are extracted from vegetables, in the 20th century, in the earlier part of the 20th century, were related to a partial deficiency of these vitamins. And it's very interesting that the mortality rate from coronary heart disease reached a peak around 1958. Actually, it's about the time I graduated from medical school. I graduated in 1959. And I was appalled when I was an intern at Mass General. I was appalled at the number of middle-aged men who came in with severe heart disease and who actually died of heart disease and some stroke as well. So the question is, well, why did this problem become an epidemic in the 1950s? And the answer is very complicated, but it was noticed about 20 years later, in 1978, that there was a declining incidence of death from heart disease. There was a very marked decline, and a conference was held at the National Institutes of Health in which the medical experts from around the country examined the reasons for this decline. The first thing they decided was the decline was real. It was not some statistical aberration, but it was a real decline. And the second thing is that by looking at all the different known factors at the time in the late 70s, they couldn't really identify a cause for it. They examined things like smoking and exercise and coronary bypass surgery and et cetera. But in looking at the homocysteine theory, it's apparent that in the mid 50s and in the early 60s, these two B vitamins, vitamin B9 or folate, and vitamin B6 pyridoxine were added to the human diet in the form of fortification and voluntary vitamin supplements. And I did a study that I reported in my monograph in 1983 showing that the intake of these two B vitamins was extremely low in the 50s, but it increased in the 60s and 70s. And it's a possible explanation of at least part of the decline. And this all occurred before the widespread use of cholesterol-lowering drugs, so that it appears that these B vitamins are critical. Now, if you have an adequate supply of the B vitamins, then obviously something else is involved, and this is a very complex area of metabolism. So this is one of the most important factors, and it was recognized in 1998 that folate or folic acid, which is a synthetic version of folate, is important in preventing birth defects. So the Food and Drug Administration in the United States mandated addition of folate in the form of folic acid to the to refined foods. And following that, what happened was in a study from the Framingham Heart Study, they showed that following fortification of the food supply, the actual blood level of folate in the blood doubled, and the homocysteine level went down about 15%. So this is an indication that these B vitamins are extremely important in controlling the level in the blood. And there was another landmark study from the Framingham study published in the American Medical Association Journal in 1993 showing that in the older participants in the Framingham study, about two-thirds of them had deficiencies in one of these three B vitamins. The folate and the pyridoxal, as I mentioned, are sensitive to food processing. B12 is a very stable molecule, but in older people it's difficult to absorb it. So the combination of these three vitamin deficiencies were associated with elevation of blood homocysteine in this Framingham Heart Study. So this is one aspect of how one can control the level of homocysteine in the blood.
So you brought up the topic of methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase, and you know that's a really hot topic nowadays. So I want to ask you, for people who have that genetic or disorder, especially the ones who have markers from both parents, does it matter if you use the synthetic version folic acid versus the active methylated form or natural form?
Well, there are some studies on this. The synthetic form that you're referring to is folic acid, and this is effective in bringing the homocysteine level down in persons with the methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase abnormality. However, as you mentioned, the methyl tetrahydrofolate is now available commercially, so one can purchase this, and this has been shown in a number of studies to be much more effective in lowering the homocysteine level. And the same thing is true of vitamin B12. The methylcobalamin, or the methylated version of vitamin B12, is more effective in lowering the homocysteine level than the cyanocobalamin version of the molecule. So you're right that these very potent B vitamins are quite effective in controlling the homocysteine level.
One thing I wanted to understand, I think I told you that I had a heart attack a few years ago and that I have double MTHFR mutations from both parents. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because I've done Siri so that my listeners have followed me through this so I can use my experience to help them. And one thing that I was doing that I can't help believe but contributed was I allowed someone to tell me that some particular vitamin, multivitamins, was very good for me. And even though I don't normally do this particular time because of the source, I believed her that these were good vitamins, and really it was all synthetic, and I just didn't know what I didn't know at the time. And I was taking massive doses, like 15 of these multivitamins a day, and because of mood disorders related to, you know, genetic issues. And my homocysteine went off the charts.
Went up?
And so when I look at it, you know, I was taking 15 of these multivitamins a day.
Oh, that's not a good idea.
That was full of folic acid. So could that, I mean, do people need to be careful about taking massive, you know, subsidized foods and multivitamins and all these things all at one time?
In general, the vitamins are very non-toxic. And I'm not sure exactly what happened in your case, but obviously you have a condition that is not rare in the population. As a matter of fact, some of the original studies from Canada showed that about 12% of the population have a version of this methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase abnormality. And in some of the earlier studies, folic acid was used. And as you mentioned, this is a synthetic version of folic acid, of folate. And I believe that the methyl tetrahydrofolate is a more effective way of controlling it, but you do not need massive quantities. You need just about 800 micrograms or less than a milligram a day is really all that's needed. And there are many studies showing that the level of these B vitamins is very modest, that most of the studies show that about 400 to 800 micrograms of folate is adequate. And in the case of vitamin B6, about 2.5 milligrams or 2,500 micrograms is adequate as a daily intake. And so that the if you have an adequate dietary or supplemental intake of these B vitamins, the homocysteine level is controlled in most cases. There are other factors, of course, that lead to elevation of homocysteine. There are over 200 different medical factors and conditions that lead to elevation of homocysteine. So the B vitamins are important, but they're not the only factors that control the levels in the blood.
Well, I have two questions that I'll put out there now. One of them is, if you would like to expand on that, other factors, or are there some that are more predominant than others that you might want to talk about?
Oh, sure.
Let me just get the second one out so I don't forget it. Looking back, if someone's looking back on their health that's had heart attacks or strokes or whatever, what symptoms could they look for that present early that would help them know that they have this problem? And I don't mean lab tests, because obviously that would do it, but are there some physical things that you would go, yep, if you'd have only paid attention to that, then you could have taken some folate and been better?
Well, I think in general, when symptoms appear from vascular disease, generally the disease is fairly advanced. Unfortunately, there are really no symptoms when you have an elevation of the blood homocysteine level. It doesn't really cause any symptoms, but it then is associated with the progression of various diseases, and vascular disease is the one we've been discussing. So if you get to the point where you're having a stroke or heart attack or angina pectoris or problems with your circulation, your peripheral vascular circulation, basically at that point the disease is fairly advanced, and homocysteine plays a part in it, but if these are not early symptoms, these are late symptoms.
Well, but, let me ask you this question then. You know, I'm 55 years old now. When I was as far back as I can remember, like junior high school, for example, I can remember that far. When I would get stressed, I would get this red flush on my chest or on my face or on my neck. Another symptom that I had was, I can remember when I was about 14, maybe, my mother took me to the doctor one time, and they told me that I was anemic, but nobody did anything about it. They didn't give me anything. It was like a statement, like, oh, the sky's blue today, you're anemic. Today, now that I take folate regularly and I do B12 regularly, I never get that red T tinge in my chest or in my face or on my neck, and I'm not anemic anymore. Could those have been early symptoms if I'd have only known?
I believe so. That's very interesting. I've never heard anyone describe this connection before to me. But the children with homocystinuria have a very interesting abnormality of the blood vessels in the skin. They have a redness of the face, and it's a condition of, especially in the face, but also in the hands and extremities. The blood vessels become dilated, and it's not rash, but it's an abnormality of the blood vessels. So this is true in children with homocystinuria.
I'll tell you another symptom I had too, but all of my children have these symptoms. So I'm imagining I've done genetics, and they all have MTRR or MTR and MTHFR. Another thing is we had lots of nosebleed. When I was young, I had lots of random nosebleed. My kids now have lots of random nosebleeds. Could that be related?
It's possible. The other thing you mentioned was anemia. The anemia can be caused by a deficiency of folate or vitamin B12. This is a recognized cause of anemia, and there are various conditions that lead up to this, either dietary deficiency or diseases like liver disease or various conditions can lead to, or malabsorption of these vitamins from the intestinal tract can all lead to anemia, so-called megaloblastic or macrocytic anemia. This is very important in recognizing the cause of anemia, especially in childhood. So I think that this is an important clue that in your case, had you known at the time, you could have had the MTHFR test and the homocysteine level checked, and then measures could be taken to control this.
Okay. Thank you because I've always wondered about that. We have about 15 minutes, and I know we still have some questions about cholesterol, microorganisms, and cancer. Just this week, someone asked me about leukemia and homocysteine. Is there any connection? Because this person has a kind of leukemia where she's anemic, but her doctor doesn't know about the genetics. And I wonder, is there any connection there? Would you like to talk about?
Well,
and also that other question where I ask you if there were some other causes. I never let you finish that.
Well, let me finish the other causes first, and then we'll get back to the cancer question. One of the most common problems in the population is hypothyroidism, or low thyroid in adults. And there are various reasons for this, but the hypothyroidism causes elevation of homocysteine levels. And of course, as you may know, people who are hypothyroid are susceptible to vascular disease, among other things. They have other problems too. But the hypothyroidism is an important contributing factor in some individuals to elevation of homocysteine. Another example is kidney failure or renal failure. If your kidneys begin to fail for whatever reason, whether it's kidney disease or vascular disease or other problems with kidney function, as the kidney function declines, homocysteine levels go up. And as you may know, people who have end-stage kidney disease have severe vascular disease, and this is sometimes the cause of death in people who have kidney failure is a heart attack or a stroke. So it's a very important factor in controlling the homocysteine level. As a matter of fact, in the some of the interventional trials, I mentioned the B vitamins. There have been a number of very large interventional trials in which people with vascular disease have been given high doses of B vitamins to see whether it makes a difference. And in general, the trials were not very successful. However, it was noted by a doctor from Canada, whose name escapes me at the moment, but he, from London, Ontario, showed that if you control for the vitamin B12 level, in other words, if a person is able to absorb vitamin B12, and if they have no renal function, then the added B vitamins seem to make a difference in their outcome in this trial. So these are some of the factors. And now we're getting back to the cancer question.
Let me ask you one question before we move on here. When it relates to the kidneys and the homocysteine and the B vitamins, is there any connection with electrolytes issues that go on? Potassium, magnesium, is there any connection? You know, some people that have this MTHFR genetic thing, they can't hold on to their electrolytes, so that they pee everything out and they have nothing left. And could that do anything, have any involvement there?
It may be related. Certainly in end-stage kidney disease, there's a problem with controlling the electrolyte concentration in the blood. That's definitely true. And what happens is the blood urea nitrogen increases and the creatinine increases, and you have a tendency to abnormalities of the blood electrolytes, the potassium and sodium and chloride and CO2, depending on the severity of the disease. So it is related. It's a complex relationship, but it is related, yes.
I can't get my head around it all so much. Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Just forget if I don't ask you.
You mentioned about the cancer. You had this person with leukemia who had anemia, and the question is homocysteine related in some way? And I believe it is. Certainly, in looking at cases of patients with different types of cancer, for example, metastatic breast cancer, leukemia, other types of serious cancers, the homocysteine level tends to be increased. And the question is, well, what does this mean, and how can this be controlled? Well, or is it important? And I can give a partial answer to that. In some studies that I did some years ago, we studied homocysteine in cultured cancer cells, and we discovered a specific abnormality of homocysteine metabolism in these cancer cells. The cancer cells were unable to convert the sulfur atom of homocysteine to sulfate. And as a result of this metabolic blockade, a form of homocysteine accumulated in the cancer cells called homocysteine thiolactone, which is a highly reactive form of homocysteine. And it reacts with the proteins and amino acids and proteins, the nucleic acids like DNA and RNA, and the glycosaminoglycans, which are connective tissue macromolecules, to cause an abnormality of these molecules. And based on this observation that my team and I made some years ago, we theorized that cancer cells are missing a derivative of homocysteine thiolactone that is present in normal cells. And based on this theory, I spent a lot of time and effort in trying to discover what this compound might be. And so my team and I synthesized about 35 new compounds from homocysteine thiolactone, that some of which had effects on cancer growth in animals, in experimental animals. And we were very encouraged by this. And eventually, we discovered that retinoic acid, which is the vitamin A acid, forms a molecule with homocysteine called thioretinamide, which we synthesized. And we showed that this molecule actually prevents cancer growth in animals and also prevents carcinogenesis in experimental animals. And one of my students also showed that it prevents vascular plaques in arteries of rats that are given homocysteine. So this compound called thioretinamide is a combination of vitamin A acid and homocysteine thiolactone. And then when I was working in Providence at the VA, I discovered that it forms a complex with vitamin B12, which is called thioretinico. And this complex also is anti-neoplastic, preventing cancer growth in animals, and anti-carcinogenic, and also anti-atherogenic in animals. And based on these compounds, I came up with a very interesting theory of oxidative phosphorylation or oxidative metabolism that I published about 20 years ago. And it says that in cancer, there seems to be a deficiency of the synthesis of these compounds. And as a result of that, the cancer cells overproduce homocysteine thiolactone, which then affects all the macromolecules in the cells that have proteins and nucleic acids. And so it's a sort of a general theory that was molecular basis based on the structure of these compounds. It's a quite interesting theory and explained some of the abnormalities of cancer cells.
So for someone, well, it seems to me that maybe perhaps that's why some of these women that have breast cancers have a problem. So if that's true, what you're saying, and I believe it probably is, what could someone do at home to help alleviate that risk?
Well, at the present time, it's really too early to say. On the other hand, I've made a proposal to do a clinical trial of this compound, this thioretinamide, on the theory that it may help to prevent or delay recurrence of cancer. But there's no published clinical trial of this compound. And so at the present time, the only advice I can give to people is to eat a healthy, nutritious diet, make sure that they minimize processed foods and eat a lot of high-quality fish, protein, eggs, vegetables, and fruits, and make sure that they have an adequate diet. But this doesn't really answer your question. It's a supportive measure, and what we're looking for is a specific way of controlling this abnormality in cancer cells, and that really remains to be seen. I think there are important leads. As a matter of fact, very recently, I became aware of a form of vitamin B3, which is nicotinamide. It's called nicotinamide riboside. This compound, when given to experimental animals or even yeast and other life forms, increases a very important coenzyme in the cells called NAD, or nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. And this compound is closely related to aging. And very recently, I have published a modification of my original theory in which this compound is critically important in the synthesis of ATP, or adenosine triphosphate, in oxidative phosphorylation. So this theory then encompasses these different B vitamins. And you've noticed I've been talking about B vitamins a lot, but all of these vitamins seem to be functioning in this area of metabolism. I already mentioned vitamin B12, vitamin B6, vitamin B9 or folate, but in addition, vitamin C, ascorbic acid, is critically important in this area of metabolism. Vitamin A, I also mentioned, and there are other vitamins that are important in this area of metabolism. So the point is that if one eats a high-quality, nutritious diet, you can guarantee yourself of an adequate intake of these crucial vitamins. This doesn't mean necessarily that it will solve a breast cancer problem, but it will tend to help general nutrition and possibly prevent new cancers from forming if the diet is adequate.
Is there? This is a little bit off, but it's still a B vitamin. I just want to ask you this before we wind up. Is there a role anywhere for riboflavin?
Oh yes, riboflavin is vitamin B2, and this molecule is also involved in energy metabolism, but it's a cofactor for methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase. So this enzyme requires riboflavin for its function. Riboflavin deficiency leads to elevation of the blood homocysteine level. So it is involved also.
That's interesting. I did a nutrient test about a year after I had my heart attack and got on the diet. Not one person told me that I should take riboflavin. But when I got that micronutrient test back, I was like in the very like zero percentile of what my levels were. So I've started taking it, but that was only in the last 6 months. So I didn't know if I could expect positive results, but it sounds like I can.
Well, riboflavin is incorporated in most multivitamin preparations, so it can be deficient. It's also related to thyroid deficiency. There's a very interesting relation to thyroid deficiency. One of my classmates, Dr. Rivlin from New York, has made many observations and studies of this. So it is closely related to the function of thyroid hormone. And so the point is that if you were deficient in riboflavin, this is an extremely important finding, and it has to be addressed. The other point that we haven't really mentioned is that it's very simple to request a homocysteine blood test. This is widely available, and it gives you a tremendous amount of information. At the beginning of the interview, you mentioned how homocysteine is an indicator of disease, of a variety of diseases. So we've only scratched the surface. And so it really, if one is interested in their total health, it behooves them to have their doctor do a blood homocysteine level to see what the level is. And if it's low, then that's good news. If it's highly elevated, you have to figure out how to control it.
And before we got about a minute, what if you're an adult, what would be the optimal range of homocysteine?
I would say the optimal range for blood homocysteine is about 4 to 8, the optimal range. The normal range in the population is around 10 or 10.5. And the homocysteine tends to go up with aging. Every 10 years it goes up a point. And this new finding with nicotinamide riboside is a possible way of controlling the elevation of homocysteine with aging and also involved in dementia, which we haven't mentioned, but Alzheimer's disease also closely related to elevation of homocysteine.
You're going to have to come back and do another show since we're running out. You have too much information.
we didn't get to microorganisms, but there, microorganisms are part of the process by which plaques are formed in the arteries, and this process involves the lipoproteins, which contain cholesterol and other fats. So this is part of the process, and my colleague Ravenskopf and I have proposed a process by which vulnerable plaques are formed in the arteries, and it involves microorganisms, which have been known for years to be involved in plaque formation.
I think that's a huge thing, and you got to promise me you'll come back and talk about that.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
One last thing. I've gotten my homocysteine, I think the last time I checked it was like 6.4.
That's excellent.
One of the docs said, oh, we wish it were a little bit higher. Do we really want it to be higher, or is it okay?
I think it's fine. There's no evidence that a low homocysteine is of any danger. It tends to be low in young children, in babies. It tends to be in the 4 range. Also in pregnancy, the homocysteine level can be around 4 to 6. But 6.5 is an excellent, it's a quite good range, and I would not worry about it.
Thank you. You're the best. Your book is fabulous. I wish that every average person, you know, walking around like me could get a copy of it and do something with it. I think it's wonderful. Thank you.
Oh,
and I'm
going
to be
welcome.
In touch really soon to get you to come back and talk some more. If you'll,
all right.
If
it's
you'll
been my
it.
Pleasure to talk with you and your listeners.
Thank you. Have a wonderful evening, Dr. McCulley.
You're welcome. Goodbye.
Goodbye.